And I think that what we need to do is really change the way that we're thinking about what loyalty is and how to build.
Hey everyone, in this episode we're talking with Zoe Skamen. She was on the podcast before, but this time we're talking about the rise of multiplayer brands and what that means for marketers. So buckle up and let's talk branding. This episode is sponsored by Creative Business Company, but more on that later.
So I am the founder of Bodacious, which is a strategy studio that's been going for about 5 years now. Prior to that, probably about 20 something years in ad agencies, innovation consultancies, client side, and yeah, just a bit of a person with itchy feet that likes to absorb lots of different things. So I hopped around a lot in my career.
Love that. Yeah, of course, you've been putting out some really fascinating decks. And of course, the links will be in the show notes. But one of them that really piqued my interest was on multiplayer brand. Mm-hmm. Very interesting concept. Maybe quickly, like, take us through what led you to just making that presentation and that concept.
I think it was an evolution more than something completely new. So I've been studying fandoms and fandom dynamics and entertainment and emerging technologies and all of these things quite a lot over the last few years. And where I started to see shifts really happening was around this kind of convergence of fans wanting more power or more control or more navigation in the IP that they were really interested in or in the brand they were interested in. New tools coming out to actually enable them to do that, that didn't necessarily require them to have, you know, hardcore coding skill sets or be adept at, you know, Adobe Photoshop or anything like that.
One of the biggest challenges in my own career has always been to convince business leaders that brand is one of the most important assets in their company. And even though dozens of studies have shown that getting the right strategic positioning can get you a 5x performance on your ads, sometimes convincing executives to prioritize their brand strategy can be challenging. That's why this episode is sponsored by Creative Business Company, a strategic consultancy on a mission to make brand more accountable and more effective. They take the lessons they've learned from over a decade of experience of working with brands such as Morningstar, Shell, and Formula E, and adapt them to smaller, fast-growing companies to help them get more attention, convert leads, and drive sales. So if you're trying to get budget for brand, create messaging that converts, or lower your cost of acquisition, check out creativebusinesscompany.com for ideas, evidence, and tools that will help you make an impact.
And then also more brands being open to this idea of plotting a path forward that is more collaborative with their customers. And so I started to see lots of different examples popping up. So Nike.swoosh would be one of them. Lego World Builder would be another one. Grimes with her elf.tech platform. And there's more and more coming, you know, every single day. And it kind of led me to this idea of, are we looking at a step change? You know, are we moving into potentially a new era of creativity where all the boundaries are kind of diminishing or blurred? And now we're starting to see consumers really step up to the plate and say, I want not necessarily just to steer some of this, but I want an equity play in it. I want to be able to navigate where my favorite brand goes next or where my favorite IP goes next. And I think it's just a really interesting space to look at. And it's also coupled with some research that I've been doing over the last 12 months into Generation Alpha, which hopefully will be released in the next couple of weeks. And that was all about looking at what they're training themselves in. And Generation Alpha are under the age of 13, so they're kids. And they are spending inordinate amounts of time within Roblox, within Minecraft. And the whole concept of what they're doing there is they are creating, these are creation games. You know, Roblox is not a games platform that creates its own games. It actually has people that kind of create avatars, game experiences, etc. Minecraft is exactly the same. And these kids are being trained on these creation tools. So Lua, coding platform, for example, how to use Minecraft, little blocks and things, and actually how to build incredible structures and sort of physics-defying things. And as they come through into being, you know, teenagers, young adults, etc., their expectations are going to be very different. They don't want finished experiences. They don't want narratives that's been written by somebody else. They want something that's more akin to a toolkit or something iterative that they can play around with.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to dive in here, but maybe taking a step back first, I think there's two things that, like, a lot of people listening might be wondering is, one, is it is it something for me? I mean, is it something for my brand or the brand I'm managing? And then maybe the part after that, like, why should I actually go and invest in this stuff?
I think it's on a case-by-case basis. I think that you can find elements of integrating multiplayer dynamics into whatever you're doing. You know, if you're a B2B, if you're enterprise, if you're selling toilet roll, you know, I'm sure you can find, you know, different aspects of it. Obviously, if the brand is much more sort of pop culture focused, or it has a definitive IP, or it works within entertainment, that's going to be something that's easier for you to be able to then step into, because you've already got those behaviors and those dynamics and that fandom to tap into. You don't have to build it from scratch. But I think that it would be remiss of people to dismiss it outright and say, actually, this is only something that works in toys or only something that works in music. And it would never work for me. I think, again, it's just about breaking down the dynamics and seeing where there might be applicability. And sorry, I've completely forgotten your second question.
No, the second one was more, no, don't worry. The second part was really more about, and I hate to say those three letters, but the ROI of it all. What is it? Is it worth investing in? And like, what are maybe some upstream business effects that you've seen with these brands?
I think the key thing when it comes to looking at ROI is we need to start evaluating brands in a slightly different way. And the reason I say that is because I'm seeing it happening more and more within the gaming space, within the music space, for example. And what I mean by that is we're starting to see these kind of ecosystems develop around different IP and different platforms. So if we take Roblox, for example, Roblox has got a really healthy marketplace. It's got a bunch of people who are creating on a spectrum from, you know, a t-shirt for their avatar all the way through to an immersive, you know, first person shooter game, for example. And the more people who are enticed to build within the Roblox ecosystem, the stronger the Roblox brand in terms of, you know, stickiness, daily active users, you know, the e-commerce side of things, the marketplace, etc. You know, Epic are doing exactly the same thing with Fortnite and Unreal Editor for Fortnite and Fab, their marketplace. They're now kind of competing with Roblox and saying, you guys can keep 80% of whatever it is that you manage to sell. You know, within our platform, we'll just take 20% for kind of fees and maintenance. Then we're also starting to see it within the likes of, you know, Nike, for example, with .swoosh. And with .swoosh, you know, I can have my own URL. So it could be .swoosh/Zoe. And I can then sell all of my virtual creations based on the 3D kits that Nike have provided me. And I can keep 100% of the proceeds. And so more and more what we're starting to see is, you know, brands, games, music platforms, for example, really thinking about how do we incentivize people to build within our ecosystem? Because if they don't build within our ecosystem, they're going to bugger off and they're going to do it somewhere else. And that's going to be painful for our brand over time. It's really going to affect, you know, the stickiness. It's going to affect, you know, the new content that's coming through. And so I think more and more when we think about ROI, we can't purely think about it in terms of, you know, someone saw an ad and then bought a product, or, you know, basket value or something like that. We have to think about long-term healthiness of brand ecosystems.
Yeah, and that last part, it reminded me a lot of, like, I think a lot of people today thinking about multiplayer brand and probably taking it down a notch would be something like what you mentioned, user-generated content, all of these things. I do see a lot more of that, where brands are starting to use that type of language, that UGC language, in their ads. But like, for you, maybe describe what the difference is between that first step of mimicking something that is organic social versus like a legitimate multiplayer brand, or is it more of like an evolution? How do you see that?
I think a lot of people are thinking it's UGC, or it's crowdsourcing, or something like that, or it's, you know, Ask Doris down the road what the next flavor of Walker's Crisp should be called. And it's not that at all. You know, it's really thinking about how can you take your customers seriously when it comes to their creative abilities, you know, their creative navigation, or the ideas that pop up. And then actually, how can you start to open your minds and also open the business up to thinking that actually maybe the best idea that's going to come out this year for a Christmas product, for example, is going to be from a fan. It's not going to be from you. You know, UGC, I think there's always going to be, you know, people creating, for example, you know, TikToks or Instagram reels or sort of spin-offs of ideas. And that's great. And that's kind of free content. But what you're looking at with multiplayer dynamics is actually how do you give people really clear briefs and parameters? within which they can produce ideas, contributions, you know, for example, new product packaging designs, new ideas for flavors of a bubblegum, that kind of stuff. But actually what you're doing is you're really bringing the best of your fans and your customers in terms of creativity closer. And you're creating a cohort of makers and creators, because there's so many out there. You know, we'd be silly to think that actually customers aren't capable of this, because of course they are. And we also need to think about incentives and remuneration, because if somebody gives you $1 million idea, they're not doing that necessarily out of the goodness of their heart. They're doing it because they are a creative at heart and they actually want to make something out of this. And that's only fair. And I think that's the kind of big key difference is, you know, UGC is just kind of playful. It's relatively trivial. It's fun when it happens. It's great. However, you know, if we shift over to, you know, what multiplayer brand dynamics are all about, it's about real creativity. It's about potentially the future of the product or service that you're offering. And it's about making sure that you're paying them fairly, you know, for their contribution to your brand. Because again, if they're building within your ecosystem, they're doing you a massive favor. Because that could potentially be the next big game on Roblox. It could potentially be the next design for a Nike sneaker that you take from virtual to physical, whatever that may be. And those ideas really do deserve proper equity and proper payment.
Mm, yeah. And maybe one thing I'm curious about, because we have seen, well, first a huge explosion when it came to all things NFT and Web 3.0, but we've also seen a bit of a, I don't know how you can call it, but you know, there's been some critical look at it, and maybe it wasn't all it was planned out to be. What role do you see for this technology like blockchain, and do you see it become more mainstream as it is today?
I don't necessarily think that blockchain or Web3 is needed for multiplayer dynamics. I think you can do a lot of it just within your own ecosystem. You know, as I said, I've mentioned Roblox and Epic and Lego and Nike, and those are not NFT or blockchain projects necessarily. But I think when it comes to what happened with NFTs and blockchain, it was a unique moment in time. You know, we were all of us sat at home, relatively bored, you know, having been in what, lockdown number three. There was a lot of kind of spare money going around because people were not going out. They weren't going to restaurants. They weren't kind of buying clothes as much, for example, because they were at home. And suddenly this kind of premise came in of, you know, if you buy these monkey JPEGs, you're going to be a millionaire tomorrow morning. And what happened is it turned it into this kind of, you know, extreme multiplayer game online, which was essentially a dopamine casino. And there was no real kind of economic structural thought behind it. However, I do think that blockchain and NFTs and kind of Web3 promise has still got so much merit within it. And I think it's silly to throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, you're not just going to look at Yuga Labs and say Yuga Labs isn't doing particularly well with, you know, Bored Ape Yacht Club, for example, and therefore it's the whole collapse of Web3. That's not true. What we're seeing instead is when the hype dies down, as is very classic of the Gartner hype cycle, the real builders come in. And that's when we're really starting to see some interesting work happening with provenance, you know, sustainability blockchains, for example. You know, the European Union is bringing out new legislation in 2026 that says that every single product that goes through the European Union has to have a digital product passport. And a digital product passport is going to be based on blockchain. And then actually, you know, companies will start to build on top of that. Hugo Boss are already experimenting with it, a few food companies, beauty companies. And I think there's going to be some really interesting spaces there. We've also got this idea of, you know, Web3 and the future of identity. And more, we've got these huge companies that actually are holding a lot of private identity information called PII. And PII is becoming more and more risky in terms of actually people holding that information. And it's also becoming more and more risk of, for, you know, attacks, for example, fraud, you know, identity theft. And so for big companies, you know, let's say it's a big retailer, for example, that's got your name and your address and your credit card details online, it's dangerous and they don't necessarily want to hold that data anymore. But the only option for them not to hold that data is to rely on, you know, customer-based digital IDs, which again have to be blockchain and Web3 enabled, so that we as customers own our own identification and we can just use it whatever, you know, retailer we go into. So that stuff is moving at pace as well. And there's a lot of really interesting projects happening there. But because people associate blockchain and NFTs with these JPEGs of monkeys and other things, they just have this black and white narrow mindset of only looking at that part of the equation and not looking at the vast enterprises that are building in these other spaces, which I think is a mistake.
Hmm. Yeah, interesting. Like, maybe there's, on this podcast, there's been like a few people in, you know, marketing science, Byron Sharp, Jenny. And of course, you know, the whole narrative around consumers being very passive, not caring about brands, them being very weak forces. How does this rhyme with this idea of fandom, and like, what do you think about that?
I disagree completely. I think that, you know, we have a spectrum of users. For example, I'm not particularly excited by my toothpaste. You know, I keep buying the same toothpaste, but I'm not wanting to join a fandom around my toothpaste. You know, I'm not particularly excited by washing up liquid, you know, that kind of stuff. So in those instances, I think especially when you're talking about someone like a Byron Sharp, he's talking about massive CPG retail companies like your Unilevers, for example. What is also happening at the same time, though, is we are seeing the birth of new companies who are focused on a new type of loyalty. And that loyalty, again, which is something that is, you know, Byron Sharp has discounted and said loyalty is a waste of time and energy and it doesn't do anything. But his version of loyalty is based on basket value. So essentially, how do I get you to buy a few more products on a more frequent basis and increase your basket value? Here's a bunch of loyalty programs based on ambiguous points. And no one knows what the fuck a point even means anymore, how you earn it, or 1,000 points, what's 100 points, who knows? And instead, you know, what we're seeing is this idea of loyalty as being a kind of digital passport, where you get stamps for your advocacy. So whether you turn up to a live event, whether you buy products on a regular basis, whether you go into digital experiences, you know, all of that kind of stuff. You've also got a really high level of what I'm calling play at the moment, which is kind of treasure hunts, competitions, you know, different ways to kind of collaborate, contribute, those types of things. And there's also then participation. So that kind of leans into this idea of the multiplayer dynamics as well. And we're seeing more and more brands really start to lean into these levers first and foremost. And actually, they've lost interest in massive growth. You know, they've lost interest in being the biggest or the fastest rising. And again, that's coming back to the change of dynamics that we've seen from an economic perspective and also a VC perspective. You know, we had this whole kind of 15, 20 year period, mostly powered by Andreessen Horowitz, which was all about growth at all costs. We don't care if you're profitable, we just want you to grow. And we saw people like, you know, Casper rise and fall. We saw Uber in a whole heap of shit because they were growing, but they had no money. You know, we saw the same with Airbnb. We saw WeWork as a collapse. You know, that happened over and over and over again. And it was because we were on this kind of growth trajectory and growth was the metric, but it wasn't necessarily sustainable. And so lots of people lost lots of money. What we're now seeing is a complete mindset shift in VCs, which is then filtering down into these new brands as well, which is actually, it's all about profitability and it's all about sustainability. And not sustainability from a climate perspective, but sustainability in terms of being able to actually keep your business afloat. And so we're moving from this era of unicorns into what some people have dubbed zebras, which I've pointed out a couple of times in some different decks that I've done. And zebras are basically saying we want profitability first and foremost, and actually growth is the kind of secondary step. So if we get to a point where we've got sustainable profitability and we're at, I don't know, 100,000 users, we're going to stop. And that's going to be the business that we're going to sustain. So it's good enough as opposed to, you know, high growth and kind of going from there. And those businesses are, as I said, using completely different dynamics. So we've got the likes of, you know, Cortez, the streetwear brand in the UK, which is all about kind of, you know, treasure hunts. So dropping, you know, map coordinates on a private Discord that you have to kind of do certain things to level up to be able to gain access to. And then suddenly there's 4,000 kids running around East London trying to find this tiny little corner shop that may or may not be selling cargo pants for 99p. And again, it's nothing to do with basket value or materialism, because the cargo pants literally cost 99p. It's to do with the fact that you've put the effort in to be such an advocate of Cortez that you have been able to access these cargo pants, and suddenly they become a measure of status. We're seeing it with Kith, for example, with their new loyalty play. And, you know, what they're doing is they're saying, you know, every single Kith purchase that you've had throughout your lifetime with the brand will be included, so you don't have to start from scratch. And not only that, we're going to release limited edition colorways based on the different tiers that you're at in the loyalty program. So if you're tier three, we're going to release a head to toe look, inclusive of, you know, exclusive trainers out of sneakers. And we're going to do it in this kind of dusty beige color. And no one else can buy the dusty beige color. You can only buy it if you're tier three of the loyalty program. And then suddenly, again, that idea of status and loyalty and play comes to the street, because you can kind of say, oh, that hoodie is not available in any other Kith store. That's only available if you're part of the loyalty program. You know, you've got Telfar, you know, for example, with their reverse pricing model, which basically says the audience is going to kind of play along and participate. And they're going to be able to be the ones that set the pricing structure. So, you know, the higher the demand in the shorter period of time, the more it's going to actually be fixed at a kind of lower cost as opposed to going higher over time. So it's the antithesis of normal luxury. You know, we've got the arrival of TYB, so Try Your Best by Ty Haney, who originally founded Outdoor Voices. And her platform is Web3, but what she's doing with a lot of different beauty brands is she's working with them to embed participation dynamics throughout all different parts of their business. And actually saying the more you bring people in, the more you create that sense of steering and autonomy from your customer base, the stickier they're going to be, the more profitable you're going to be. Ergo, that's the kind of way to go. So I'm seeing it, you know, across so many different categories at the moment. I'm seeing completely different dynamics when it comes to how we define loyalty, away from points and basket value and into this kind of play, passports, participation angle. And that to me is really exciting. And that's, I think, where you build fandom. That's where you build advocacy. And to kind of write that off wholesale, I just think is madness, because I can see so much shifting in that direction.
I created this podcast to help myself and others understand the power of brand building without all of the BS. So here's three no BS guides from my friends at Creative Business Company that you can download for free to drive impact. The Brand Investment Blueprint outlines the exact process they use to convince skeptical executives to invest in brand building projects and campaigns. How Challengers Can Position for Growth explains how brands can find and leverage their hidden advantage to create brand marketing that sells. And last, my favorite, How to Build a Big Brand on a Small Budget explores how to outsmart and overtake market leaders with more cost-effective marketing. Go to creativebusinesscompany.com/staff to download your free guides today. That's creativebusinesscompany.com/STEF to download your free guides today. Back to the podcast.
Yeah, totally. And like, I've seen it in my own work in the last years. Like, I've kind of abandoned some of these hard principles and just started looking at how can we engage, for example, a huge customer base through some of these interesting campaigns. And I've already seen like the results and the tangible impact you have can be huge. So it's definitely something interesting. And it begs the question, like, when it comes to the making the choices as a marketer, let's say at a smaller brand, often it's about, okay, we have to invest in reaching so many people through these or these channels. Mm-hmm. And it begs the question whether maybe we've been looking at the wrong metrics in terms of like share of voice versus maybe what you're saying is more like almost a depth in the voice and the channels, and maybe even more looking at your own customers. I don't know how you feel about that, but.
Again, I think it's case by case. So I think, you know, if you've got a brand, for example, which has got significant VC backing and, you know, you're tied into a set of golden handcuffs and you have to get to a certain earning capacity in a 3-year time window, then you have to pursue, you know, growth as well as depth. If you have the luxury of more time and more space and you don't have a burning platform in terms of, you know, money running out, for example, and salaries to pay, then I think you can look at it in a different way. But I think the smart choice would be to do both. If you're a startup and a scale up, and to invest in what we call, you know, growth marketing or performance marketing, whatever you want to call it, but also looking at actually, are there possibilities for us to build depth? Because the depth side of things is the stuff that really creates real value and real stickiness. And that can then look at, you know, how does those advocates bring in new advocates, and actually do they become their own marketing force, either kind of overtly or inadvertently? And I think that's a really interesting play as well. So I think the smart choice would be both, but obviously looking again at kind of profitability and what your success metrics actually are. And I think, again, you know, growth at all costs and following a sort of an enterprise level CPG best practice is not a smart move, you know, for a very small brand that's operating in today's dynamics. And so I don't think we can take those, you know, whatever we call marketing truths that have been etched into the tablet of time and say they're still relevant. I don't think they are.
Maybe let's dive a bit deeper into like some of the ways that customers or consumers can join in like co-creating a brand. You mentioned in your presentation, for example, AI. Could you elaborate a bit on how that can enable consumers to join?
Yeah, I think, again, there are loads of different use cases. You know, one of the ones that I've outlined in the deck is Grimes and what she's doing with Elf.tech. And so Grimes, obviously, people don't know her. She's a music artist, you know, relatively famous for shacking up with Elon Musk for 5 minutes and then having the sense to leave him. And she's always been on the forefront of emerging technologies. Like, she was one of the very first artists to invest in world building. You know, she created an avatar, and she created this kind of Anthropocene futuristic world that she resided in. And now she's embracing AI. And what she's seeing is that there's no stopping, you know, what's happening with AI at the moment, especially from a music perspective, because of the ease of people being able to kind of mimic your voice and all of the training data that is publicly available because of the music you've put out. And so she said, you know, rather than fighting it, what if I embrace it and actually explore a completely different revenue stream and creative outlet for me as an artist? So with Elf.tech, she's essentially allowing people to license her voice and to create new music with her voice. And all she's asking for is, if a particular track takes off and kind of starts racking up, you know, listens on Spotify, for example, she wants 50% of the equity on that. And that's more than fair. And so the interesting thing with that is, because these tools are so open and anyone can actually use them, regardless of their music making skill. Obviously, they need to have some level of taste, otherwise it's going to be a shit track. But, you know, you can bring together orchestrations, you can create melodies, you can create lyrics, all of those things. And bringing this all together, suddenly anyone kind of can create music, and say the next big hit track from Grimes could actually be something that she didn't write herself. And actually it was her voice that was licensed to make it happen. And I think that stuff is really interesting. You know, I think there are, there's brands like Coca-Cola, for example, that have obviously trained an AI on all of their design and advertising and kind of film work for the last 100 years, and is opening it up to a small set of creators to co-create what new packaging might look like, what new kind of brand ideas might look like. Obviously, the whole thing, as I said, is trained on their heritage. So there's a level of kind of parameters and guidelines, but there's also a level of generative freedom, which I think could be really interesting. You know, what if there was an AI that was trained on Harry Potter, and then suddenly that became, you know, the definitive Harry Potter AI to produce potentially spin-off stories, or, you know, new characters or new worlds, or, you know, parallel narratives that could actually come to life in different ways. I think, again, that stuff is really fascinating. So I think we're going to see more and more brands dip their toe in that water and realize that actually what they're building is these kind of huge creative vaults. And actually handing the keys over to fans, obviously with, you know, certain guardrails and parameters in place, could be a really interesting exercise in opening up the next chapter.
Yeah, and I think that's a big part of also of what you mentioned in the deck, is that brands are having to let go of control a bit, but at least by investing in this technology and being upfront with it, you'll get to have more say than just letting people do it, I guess.
Yeah, and I think the key thing is, this is not a everything is dead, this is the new thing. Because I think that rhetoric is ridiculous. And I think I said it in the deck as well. It's about layering. So there's a lot of, you know, guff out there at the moment. I saw something last week about it, which is, you know, brand guidelines are dead because now it's all about being represented by creators. And I was like, what a load of shit. Because if you don't have, you know, if you don't have a brand guideline, or if you don't have certain kind of parameters of what a brand means, then you don't have a brand. You know, a brand has to stand for something. So it's not about saying, right, what you need to do is open your doors, you know, let anybody decide, you know, how they interpret their brand, give over full control to a whole group of customers and fans and be done with it. Like, that's madness. You know, what instead you need to be thinking about is actually, how do we still keep a grip on what this brand is, but actually have different facets of it that potentially we pilot in terms of open experiments, or little bits of IP that we allow people to play with, and we see where that goes. And it's an experiment process. You know, it's not kind of going from black to white overnight. There is a way for us to look at different, you know, extremities of the brand, or different edge cases of the brand, which could be more open, and actually then to see kind of where that leads. And that's what Nike's doing with Dot Swoosh. It hasn't opened up its entire design process and said, hey, go for your life. Instead, it's kind of really controlling this. And that's why it's a beta group of people. It's a closed cohort. It's an experiment. You know, that's the kind of stuff that most brands should be playing with right now.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about communities in the previous podcast episode as well, but there are some interesting things you iterate on in the deck, things like Cozy Web, and how does this play into this whole story of multiplayer brand?
So I think, so, you know, the Cozy Web thing that I talked about, I did that in the kind of decoding communities deck beginning of last year. And what we're starting to see at the moment for the very first time is a drop in usership across big social. So, you know, last year, for the very first time, Facebook usage actually decreased, which has never happened before. There's lots of people arguing at the moment that TikTok is starting to plateau for a number of different reasons, obviously, you know, government and Congress stuff aside. And it's true. And the reason that is happening is because we've got to a point with social media where we've realized that the big experiment has failed. The whole point was, let's all get in a big town hall together and spend time together. And aren't we all going to be happy and holding hands and, you know, laughing? And instead, what we've done is we've realized that actually human beings don't always share context. And when we're all in one space and we have different values, different belief systems, etc., we clash. And it actually increases division. It increases, you know, hate language and rage culture. And obviously, again, all of the algorithms that we've been exposed to are then kind of driving that even more so, because obviously these businesses are advertising based. So what they want to do is maximize engagement, maximize eyeballs, dwell times. And, you know, unfortunately, these algorithms have learned that the best way to do that is to serve us stuff that makes us angry. And therefore, we're more likely to share it, we're more likely to spend time with it and be outraged by it. And lots of people are saying, I don't want to do this anymore. You know, I want to step off this roundabout and actually say, this is enough. And I don't feel happy and I don't feel healthy in these spaces. And so we're seeing a retreat into, you know, what Venkatesh Rao called the cozy web. Or Yancey Strickler, the co-founder of Kickstarter, he calls it the dark forest of the internet. And what they mean by that is that the vast majority of the internet is basically bots and algorithms, and there's kind of very little humanity left to it. And so we're seeing people retreating into these spaces where they can refind their humanity. And they do that by going into these kind of pockets of community. And those pockets are where you have shared context, you know, you should have shared values. There's more empathy, there's more kindness, it's a more pleasant experience. And so we're seeing people move away from Facebook, you know, X, for example, especially has turned into a complete hellscape after Elon Musk takeover. And instead, we're seeing people in WhatsApp groups and Discord servers and private Finsters and closed, you know, communities within white label services. The difficulty with that from a brand perspective is, how the hell do you find those people? And how do you engage them? And yes, you can build, you know, your own community, but also how do you kind of draw people out, you know, and into your ecosystem? And that's, again, why the multiplayer dynamics are quite interesting, because you're turning brand from this kind of passive thing that we have at the moment, where we kind of watch social content they create, or we watch a tele ad that they create, or we might go into a store. And instead, you're inviting them into your version of a cozy web experience, where it's much more of a kind of reciprocal communication. It's much more of a, you know, a mutual value exchange. It's much more of a, I care what you think as a customer, and I want to involve you in this process. And I also want to incentivize you to be here and spend time with this brand. And so we are having to see, you know, completely different shifts in brand behavior and actually the expectations that consumers are having because of this big move from, you know, social into cozy web.
Yeah, this rings so true to me. Again, like we're working on a campaign right now, and we have people in a Strava community, and like also mixed with that with a WhatsApp group. And the fun thing is seeing these people like create Strava art and talking about it in the WhatsApp groups. And it's so different from a traditional campaign that is put out there, and you're just hoping people see it and maybe stick around for a bit and then maybe click on. It's like a completely different style of working. But I can imagine like a lot of people listening being like a bit fearful of that, in the sense that, how are we ever gonna get people to be excited about something when it's even already so hard today to get their attention with what they're doing? Like, what would be your advice or spiritual guidance over there?
I think it's the way that we see advertising has to change. I think, you know, at the moment we have all been trained, myself included, on how to build a sausage factory. So we essentially kind of go through this conveyor belt of creating campaign assets, which might take, I don't know, 6 months. We break it up into bits of content and, you know, social bits and posters and all this kind of stuff. And then we throw it out into the ether and we let it run for a couple of weeks, and then we do the whole thing all over again. And so what we're really, really good at is basically kind of short, sharp campaign thinking, where we don't really think about what we've put out there. We just get back to the process and we make the sausage all over again. And instead, I think, you know, what we need to learn is, how do we build long-standing relationships? How do we learn from the best practices of CRM, for example, coupled with what's happening within cozy web, coupled with what's happening in pop culture, coupled with what's happening in kind of multiplayer dynamics and gaming, and bring that to the fore? But as agencies, the way that we work, the way that we bill, you know, the way that we train our talent is sausage factory dynamics. And what we're saying now is actually that's not what we need to do. It's not about short, sharp stuff that we just kind of vomit over people when they're scrolling through their social feeds. How do we build community? How do we build long-term relationships? What does that look like? You know, from a content perspective, how do we then embed that further within the business? And actually, how do we attach it to R&D? How do we attach it to, you know, for example, ideas with new product development and packaging design and distribution and retail experiences and all of that kind of stuff? And we are not trained to do that. We don't have those skills. We are also not particularly well connected on the whole within organizations outside of the marketing department. And so we fail, you know, at the first hurdle. And actually, we say this is too hard. You know, we don't want to do this because we can't do it and it's going to take too long to retrain us. And how do we charge for it? Because the P&L says X. And so we just put our heads in the sand and we continue to do what we've always done because it's easier.
Yeah. And maybe like there's also a thing about this changing a bit the dynamics between agencies and in-house. I don't know, but I have a feeling that this type of muscle has to be somewhat in-house if you want to do it long-term.
I think aspects of it definitely do. I think if you're talking about running a tight-knit branded community, then you are much better doing that in-house. That's not to say that agencies can't play a role in that in terms of feeding that community with ideas, with certain kind of content rhythms, for example. You know, looking at it as basically building another channel for a brand, which is owned, which you can leverage, you know, as an agency partner. But I think the key thing at the moment is agencies need to take a really long, hard look at what it is that they are offering, and how they bill and how their talent is trained and, you know, how they actually put timesheets together, for example, and say, is this the best model moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much more I'd love to dive into, but I would recommend people to go check out the deck and all the other amazing stuff you're doing, Zoe. Maybe give us one like a sneak peek or teaser. What else is coming in the future that we might be interested in?
I'm going to work on a deck which is about the new landscape of loyalty, which I kind of just touched on a bit earlier in our conversation, because I do really want to put that thinking out there. I think the way that our default brain works when it thinks of loyalty is basket value, point systems, you know, spend £5, get 2 points or something like that. And I think that what we need to do is really change the way that we're thinking about what loyalty is, and how to build it. And I think, again, that could be a new skill that agencies can lean into. I think the key thing for me is that I'm never not learning, and I'm never not trying to change my approach or experiment with new methodologies or new platforms, new tools, new ideas. And I think you have to, you know, in this day and age, because we're just seeing so much change happen at the moment that to push against it, or just to be even worse, you know, to be passive in the face of it, I think is going to put a shelf life on you pretty quickly.
Amazing. Thanks so much for coming on the show again, Zoe.
No problem.
All right, that was it for this episode. As always, if you want to stay up to date on the latest episodes, check out the show notes and find out more interesting stuff about brand strategy and brand building, visit letstalkbranding.substack.com. That's letstalkbranding.substack.com.